I'd like to look at the book of Proverbs in this series of studies. Not a terribly popular book for preachers. In fact, I don't know that I've ever heard a series of studies on the book of Proverbs, and certainly I've never given a series. So we'll see what happens as we move through this book together. To start with, some background information about the book of Proverbs. In every language and culture of the world, I'm sure they have Proverbs. In ancient times, in modern times, we condense wisdom from observing society. We condense wisdom into short, pithy sayings, which hopefully convey some sense to people. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. A stitch in time saves nine. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Whether you'd call those proverbs, I don't know. But you know the sort of short, pithy saying. That's what this book is about. And a lot of these sayings you'll find here are not particularly religious. But then a lot of our lives are not particularly religious either. We're not always at meetings, we're not always praying and walking in the heavenlies. Most of our lives are very humdrum things, eating food, going to work, cleaning up the yard, looking after children. Just ordinary humdrum things. And we've got to see that in those areas too, our faith is practical. That's what we're concerned with here in the book of Proverbs. These, of course, are Hebrew proverbs, and so we have to consider them in the context of the Hebrew people in ancient times. There's a lot of common sense even in these non-Hebrew countries. As you read through the Bible, you'll find a lot of non-Israelite wisdom is mentioned. We find it talked about that there were wise men in Teman, in Edom, the wisdom of the Chaldeans, the wisdom of Egypt. Moses trained in the wisdom of Egypt. And if you look through some of the ancient wisdom writings of those countries, you'd find there are many parallels to the proverbs that we have here in the book of Proverbs. And I'm sure that if we looked at the proverbs we have in English and went, for example, to a place like Thailand, where I come from, we'd find some striking parallels. Because the observations of life and the common sense which is suggested is fairly common throughout the whole human race. But the great difference between the Hebrew wisdom and the non-Hebrew wisdom, that is the Egyptian, the Chaldean, the Edomite wisdom and other wisdom from countries round about, the great difference was that you find no trace of idolatry, no trace of immorality, no trace of injustice, no trace of the upper classes getting their claws on the lower classes in any of this wisdom. Because the basis of Hebrew wisdom was the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's in the opening chapter here in Hebrews. So that the whole of the wisdom is directed towards an understanding of God and living a life that is in keeping with His law. Now, many of these proverbs are not even going to mention God, but they are a reflection of the lives of people who are living according to the requirements of God's law. You find in those ancient times that there was a lot of intercourse between the different nations as they exchanged wisdom. I think that's why it is that there are so many proverbs that are common to people in various countries. You've all read the book of Kings and read about Solomon, the greatest of all the wisdom teachers. Well, we find as we read that book that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East. So wisdom teaching was common throughout the East. It says that it was greater than the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than a number of people mentioned here. Ethan, he was an Ezraite, a man called Heman, another one called Calcol, and one called Dada. And they were all from outside of Israel. Famous wise men of ancient times. And Solomon, it says, was wiser than all these chaps. His fame spread to all the nations round about. It goes on to say that men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And we have the story of the Queen of Sheba who came, it says, to test his wisdom and to put some hard questions to him to see how smart he really was. It also goes on to tell us that he uttered 3,000 proverbs and he had 1,005 songs. Those verses I read to you are from the last four or five verses of 1 Kings chapter 4. There's no doubt that wisdom was a very important type of teaching in ancient Israel. If you cast your mind back to the beginnings of Israel, we have the priests as being the main teachers. If you read through the books of Moses, you'll find it repeated on several occasions that the priests were to be the teachers of the law. As time moved on, you find that there are other teachers appear on the scene, and they were the prophets. And whereas the priests were the teachers of the law as given to Moses, the prophets were more the preachers, the men who brought God's thundering denunciations on sin, who preached exhortation to the people, sought to stir them up and to follow in the ways of God. So there were the priests, there were the prophets, and there were also the wise men. And the wise men were a different category again. They were the people who observed life, and on the basis of their observations, they made suggestions. And you'll find the three groups are referred to together on several occasions. The most notable is in Jeremiah chapter 18, verse 18, where it talks about the priest, the prophet, and the wise man. So they were the three main categories of teachers in the nation Israel. We're concerned with the wise men tonight. Their subject matter was, of course, drawn from the whole spectrum of human life. Sometimes you'll find they're talking about very minor things. A nagging person in a house, bad table manners, talking too much, ordinary little things that just plain get on your nerves. And then sometimes they talk about big things, such as how to rule the nation, how to bring up your family, how to worship God, and then everything in between. Most of the orthodox teaching is collected here in Proverbs. Now, by orthodox teaching, I mean what you can say is the general rule. And you're familiar with this sort of thing, you'll get a verse that says something like this: if you walk in the ways of the Lord, you will have prosperity and a long life, but the wicked will be consumed and brought to dust. Something like that. Now, that is a general statement, and that is the sort of statement you get in Proverbs. But it's not the whole story, because there are exceptions. And when you come to Job and Ecclesiastes, which are the other two wisdom books, there are three wisdom books, there's Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes. Proverbs gives us the orthodox, the mainline general teaching. Job and Ecclesiastes investigates the exceptions. Because although Proverbs will tell us, fear the Lord and you will enjoy prosperity in a long life, whereas the wicked will be consumed, Job says, but that's not always the case. Because sometimes you fear the Lord and you suffer. And sometimes the wicked prosper. How do you answer that one? Ecclesiastes says the same. I have seen wicked men prolonging their days and nothing happens to them. And I have seen a righteous man perish in his righteousness. We're going to look at the easy ones tonight. We're going to look at Proverbs and we'll follow through the main general teaching. If you want to look at how the biblical writers handle the exceptions, read the book of Job and read the book of Ecclesiastes. The way the book divides up is that the opening nine chapters give us a discourse between a father and a son, or if you like, between a teacher and his pupil, which I would suggest is more likely to be the case. In ancient times, as you well know, the teacher referred to his pupils as my son. And even in the New Testament times, you'll find older men referring to their offside as their younger men as their sons. It could be a father and a son, literally, but it's most likely a wisdom teacher and one of his pupils. And so in the opening nine chapters, you have this rather lengthy discourse. It's really very interesting, that opening nine chapter section. I'm not going to look at it tonight because it really is quite different from the rest of the book. I want to come back next week and look at chapters 1 to 9 because I'll be dealing with that in quite a different way from the way I'm dealing with these few proverbs tonight. Tonight I want to look at some of the miscellaneous proverbs of Solomon. From chapter 10 through to chapter 24, or rather 22, we have a total of 375 Proverbs of Solomon, all collected together and not necessarily connected with each other. They're just a miscellaneous collection. The end of chapter 22 plus the next couple of chapters gives us a collection from other Hebrew wisdom writers. I don't know the exact number there, you could count it up if you wanted to, but there is a collection there of miscellaneous proverbs from various other wise men. You then come back to get a second collection of five chapters of more of Solomon's wise sayings. And it tells us in chapter 25 that these were put together by some of Hezekiah's men. You remember King Hezekiah? He was one of the good kings of Judah, and after a time of great rebellion against God and forgetting his law and departing from him, Hezekiah came along and he had wide sweeping reforms. And there must have been some of his men who decided that they would get back to some of the basic common sense Hebrew wisdom that Solomon taught. And it says that Hezekiah's men made a collection of proverbs. And so they have been incorporated in the book as well, 128 of them altogether. And then finally, the last two chapters, we have two chapters that are quite different from the rest of the book because they are non-Hebrew wisdom. If you look at the writers in those last couple of chapters, you'll find that they are men from outside Israel. Yes, they were men who feared God, and of course there were people outside Israel who were believers in God, and you find the wisdom of some of these men is collected at the end. I'm sure you've read some of them. You know those that collection of there are three things that are this and there are four things that are something else, and the ant is doing something and the badgers are making little dams and the spiders are all working together, and all those very colourful illustrations from nature, and of course the little account there of the perfect wife that comes right at the end of the book. So you have those final two chapters of miscellaneous wisdom from the non-Hebrew writers. What I want to do tonight now is to look at some of Solomon's Proverbs. Just a tip, when you're reading the book of Proverbs, I think it's a good idea not to try to read too much at once. People have a funny approach to the Bible, you know. They read the whole Bible as if it's all the same right through, which is really a very inadequate way of studying the Bible, and we're doing ourselves a disservice if we read it that way. Some people read the Bible as if every verse is a little pious saying that somehow is full of deep spiritual truth. But it's not that way at all. Sometimes you'll get a whole book that really is just telling you a story, or you'll get chapter after chapter simply developing a narrative. And it may not be that every single line has within it a well of deep spiritual truth. They may just be telling us a bit of background story so that we can get the gist of what's going to follow. Other books, of course, such as Romans and Hebrews and the like, they are packed full of truth so that you have to really pull them apart and go into them in great detail because the writers intend you to. Some books are poetry. Some books are lists of names which aren't of great interest to us at all. What we've got to do, of course, is see what type of literature each of these books is, and we have to read it accordingly. Our standard Bibles have divided the Bible up into verses, which is very convenient for finding the place, but sometimes it's very inconvenient because it breaks up the flow of thought. When the men wrote these things, they didn't write in chapters and verses, they just wrote the same as you or I would write. And somebody came along later and thought they'd chop it up into verses so that we could find our places much easier. Well, we do find our places more easily. But sometimes because we stop and start and stop and start after every sentence, we lose the flow of things. When you're reading an epistle, for example, it's probably a good idea to read the whole thing through, because that's the way it was read through when it was first written. And the whole church got the whole letter in one hearing. And you maybe get more that way because you get the flow of the thought. But when you come to Proverbs, you have to read them just line by line, verse by verse. Now, if we sit back and read Proverbs three chapters in a night straight off, we might not get much benefit at all. If we're reading 1 Kings or 2 Samuel, we'll read three or four chapters straight through is probably the best way to do it. But when we read Proverbs, I think the best thing to do is to take it in small bits and maybe do half a chapter or something like that and chew over it and think about it. and each verse is a separate proverb, with the exception of the first 9 chapters. As you get onto the Proverbs, what they require is thought, meditation, and probably memorization, if they're really going to be of benefit to us. A lot of them are not terribly difficult to understand, but if we stop and just think of the implications, I think we'll find they are very, very practical. And I would like these talks to be very practical. We'll get our bearings from the opening chapter by reading through these first 7 verses, just so that we have the basis of the book. The man gives us his purpose in collecting these proverbs. We notice at the beginning that they're the Proverbs of Solomon, which of course applies to the relevant section, which is chapters 1 to 9, and then later on you'll find again in chapter 10 it says these are the Proverbs of Solomon, and later on it will say these are the Proverbs of somebody else. But this is the purpose, verse 2, that men may know wisdom and understand and instruction, understand words of insight, receive instruction in wise dealing, righteousness, justice and equity. Now there's a good balance there if you just look at it. In verse 2, to know wisdom and instruction, the mind has to be instructed, we have to get the knowledge. But verse 3 says we've got to put it into practice. Wise dealing, righteous behavior, justice, equity. There is a balance and we need both. Some people think it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you do right things. And some people think that you can believe correctly and then act in some other way. We're not to overbalance either way. We are to have a right understanding and exercise our minds to improve them and understand the truth. We also to make sure that that truth works itself out in practical daily living. It goes on in verses 4 and 5 to show that it applies to everybody. He talks about the simple, who are not those that are below par mentally, but those who are immature. The youth at the end of verse 4. It's applicable to the immature, to the young, but even in verse 5, the man who's already mature, the wise man, the older man, he needs it also, he says. He wants to hear instruction and increase in learning. We never have fully arrived. We can always learn more. So whether we are young or old, whether we are immature or have been along the track a long time, the writer tells us that the book of Proverbs is for us all. Verse 6, to understand a proverb and a figure. Notice the word there, he says a figure. And at the end of verse 6, the words of the wise and their riddles. I'm reading incidentally from the Revised Standard Version, and your version may say something slightly different in some of these verses. But here he is saying that the proverbs are not always straightforward. Sometimes there's a bit of a riddle attached to them. Sometimes he speaks in a figure of speech. You'll find that some of them are very ironical. Some of them are a little bit sarcastic. Some of them are quite funny. They're intended to be funny. In our readings in our family some time ago, we read through the book of Proverbs and we used the Good News Bible. And if you've got a Good News Bible, you'll get yourself a few good laughs as you go through Proverbs, because the artist has put along the top of the page about half a dozen drawings on each page illustrating some of the Proverbs. And I really think they're spot on, the illustrations. They'll make you smile, but that's what the writer intended us to do. Sometimes he's pulling us up with a jolt, and sometimes he's getting his message across just like a cartoonist in the newspaper gets his message across, by distorting something a little bit and just giving you a bit of a grin, but it really gives you the point that he's getting at. But what's the overall purpose? Verse 7, the fear of the Lord. That's the basis of the wisdom, and that is the goal to which it is to lead us. The guiding principle is always a right relationship with God. From here on, I want now to look at 2 topics, and what I've done is to go through about 20 chapters, and I've picked out verses all along the way, so we'll be turning over all the time as I move from one to the other. I'm going to go through, first of all, one topic, which is a topic relating to work, laziness, and things of that nature. And all of us are concerned with those matters. And then I want to come back and look through at a second topic. And we'll look at those two and just see some of the miscellaneous proverbs scattered through this book, but yet they're all bearing upon those subjects. We'll start in verse 10 through to verse 15, where we have a picture here of a person who tries to get rich in a hurry. It's also a bit of a lesson for us in the problem of bad companionship. Beware, he says, my son, in verse 10, if sinners entice you, don't consent. If they say, come with us and let us lie in wait for blood and let us wantonly ambush the innocent like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole like those who go down to the pit, we shall find all precious goods, we shall fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot among us, we'll all have one purse. Let's go down and stick up a bank, hide behind a corner, rob the hamburger bar or something like this. They're out to get some cash and they're going to take it home and then split it up between them. Be in with us. The basic fault here is the desire to get rich quick. Now, other people try to get rich quick by going in for the lottery or other forms of gambling. That's inside the law. This here is outside the law. But as far as the Christian is concerned, they both are based on a fundamentally wrong principle. And that is that we want to get a lot in a short time without expending any energy in getting it. And that is contrary to what God has laid down in his word from the first chapter of the Bible to the last. It is always God's will that we work for what we get. And there are many proverbs which tell us that if we get things for nothing, as our own English proverbs tell us, easy come, easy go. There's no value to it, and ultimately it can lead to trouble. So what he's saying here is this. I know that all of you somehow want to get some money in a hurry. We've all been in this position. There's been a hospital bill for $700 come in, or there's a mortgage on the house and the car has just broken down and we need a new engine, and somehow the old family budget has taken something of a thumping. And if only something would fall out of the sky, or somehow we'd get that lump of cash. Now the Christian, of course, resists those temptations, or I hope so. But here it is, you see, the desire to get rich. And so the man is giving his advice, verse 15, my son, don't walk in the way with them, hold back, resist the temptation. If you want prosperity, you've got to work for it. So turn over, please, to chapter 6, verse 9. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? Here he's getting stuck into one of these lazy people that's lolling around and not doing anything. There are many proverbs like this. When will you rise from your sleep? One or two mothers have quoted this to their sons at times, I think. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber. What he's saying here is that if you don't stir yourself, if you insist on being lazy and lolling around the place and not lifting your finger to do anything, then you'll get worse and worse. And the time will come when you won't be able to do anything, and you won't be able to work or get any cash, and so he says, you'll find yourself in strife. Laziness is never to be commended. Over to chapter 10, verse 4. This is on the same theme. A slack hand causes poverty. Now see, this is the general statement. I think you all know of people that have been slack and somehow they've come into some cash. You also know people who've worked hard and through some misfortune have lost the lot. That's the exception. But the general observation is that a slack hand will cause poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Well, you might come back and say, but I don't want to be rich. Well, that's fair enough too. In fact, it's quite commendable. But although there's no shame in being poor, there is shame in being lazy. And I think we have to make a distinction here. He's not saying that to be poor is shameful. He's not saying that to be out of work through no fault of your own is shameful. He's not saying that to receive help from some other person is shameful. What he's saying is that slothfulness is shameful. Laziness is shameful. And there's quite a difference. The son who gathers in summer is prudent in verse 5, but a son who sleeps in harvest brings shame. He brings shame on himself, he brings shame on his family, he brings shame on his father. There's dad and all the others out there gathering in the harvest, and there's this lazy chap lying at home, sleeping while all the others are out there working. That's the shameful thing. Being poor, well, those other things I mentioned are not shameful. being lazy is. Chapter 12, verse 11. Perhaps you could apply some of these things to the local church. It's not short of lazy people at times. I'll leave you to work out the implications. He who tills his land, chapter 12, verse 11, will have plenty of bread. But he who follows worthless pursuits has no sense. Once again, you might say, but I don't want to have plenty of bread. I just want to have enough bread. Give us this day the bread sufficient for this day. Okay, if you want that, well, fair enough. That is still no excuse for following worthless pursuits in the second half of the verse. You have no interest in plenty? Okay, but that is still no need or no excuse to follow worthless pursuits. He who follows worthless pursuits has no sense. Have you met the person that's rather blasé and says, oh, I don't care, I don't want to be rich, I don't want to have a lot of cash, as long as I can just move around and do this and keep myself out of jail, and so he lives a rather reckless sort of a life. Well, he doesn't want to have plenty of bread, he may not even want to be rich. But there's still nothing to commend in an attitude to life which is worthless, or which follows worthless things. And even if we are diligent people, it's still possible for us to be sidetracked with worthless pursuits. One might think of some of the areas of entertainment, some of the things we watch on TV. I'm not saying TV's wrong. I'm just saying we have to keep an eye on ourselves and ask ourselves, are these things worthwhile or are they worthless? Nothing wrong with relaxation, nothing wrong with recreation and hobbies, but are they worthwhile or are they worthless? He who follows worthless pursuits has no sense. And if he's a Christian who follows worthless pursuits, well, he's even more to blame, because he ought no better. Chapter 15, verse 19. The way of the sluggard is overgrown with thorns. He won't work. But the path of the upright is a level highway. Perhaps there's some element of dishonesty in the sluggard here, because he's contrasted not with the hard worker but with the upright person. And the way of the upright is a level highway. To go straight, to be the sort of person that's straight up and down, in the long run, that is the best course. The person who's not straight, the person who doctors his conversation and behaviour so that he's always popular, no matter who he's speaking to, that's the sort of person who creates the troubles in the world. Sometimes the person who's straight may be a little abrasive and he may not always be popular, and one is not going to commend harshness or rudeness. But sometimes I think we need to realise that there is a cost in being honest, and it may mean we're not going to be popular if we're going to speak the truth. Straight is best in the long run. The path of the upright is a level highway. Across to chapter 18, verse 9, there's another interesting one there. He who is slack in his work is a brother to him who destroys. That means they go hand in glove. It's bad enough to destroy something. Well, he says, if you're lazy, that's just as bad. One is as bad as the other. To leave a job undone, which you should have done, is just as bad as destroying what has already been done. Did you get that? To leave undone what should be done is just as bad as destroying what has been done. He who is slack in his work is hand in hand with the person who destroys work. Across to chapter 19, there's a little collection there, I think. Is it chapter 19, verse 24. Oh, this is one of those comical ones. Where the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, and he will not even bring it back to his mouth. Can you get the picture? One of these dips, we have a little savoury, and you stick it in some dip and feed your mouth with it. Here's the character, he's got his hand in the dip, and he just hasn't got enough enthusiasm to lift it to his mouth. So our writer here is not short of a sense of humour. Well, there's a few scattered illustrations of the danger of laziness. Well, before we start congratulating ourselves, I think there's another side to this. Some of us don't have any danger of being lazy because we have a sort of built-in workaholic mechanism. And it's very easy for that sort of person then to congratulate himself and to sit back and think, none of these verses apply to me because I'm a hard worker anyway. And a lot of Christians are hard workers. And Christians seem to get on pretty well in the world, generally speaking, and so they move up through the middle classes to the upper middle classes and then congratulate themselves that diligence has been blessed by God and it is a worthy Christian characteristic. All that may be so. But because we have not failed in these areas, that doesn't mean to say we may not fail in another area. The two extremes. The extreme we've looked at is the extreme of laziness and slothfulness. The opposite extreme is the one of outrageous ambition, selfish ambition, status climbing, being so ambitious that we can't help ourselves and we've got to keep on climbing up the ladder and walking over other people. Well, the man in Proverbs has a bit to say about that, and so we'll go back now and we'll start all over again. Could you go back, please, to chapter 12, verse 9. All of us here are going to be tempted in one or both of these two extremes. Chapter 12, verse 9. Better is a man of humble standing who works for himself than one who plays the great man but lacks bread. When it says works for himself, this is not a verse that you are to use against the multinationals or to say that the man who's in his own private business is the God-appointed man. When it says the man of humble standing who works for himself, it means the man who goes and makes some fried rice and goes and sells it around the streets, or he goes around with a spanner and tightens up people's leaky pipes or whatever they had in those days. Here's the man who is an artisan, he's a man of humble standing, and he's no great person in the community. But he's looking after himself and he bothers nobody. Well, says the man, it's better to be like that than this other character who plays the great man but lacks bread. And here's the character that is sponsoring everybody around the district, and you see his name all over the place and a big splash on the telly, and he's really in all the clubs, and he's bought himself a yacht, and he's joined another club and another club, and he's entertaining five nights a week, and the next minute you know he's gone to the wall and his company is 100,000 in the red. Now that's what he's talking about here. He's playing the great man, and then one day the whole thing cracks and he's lacking bread. Status climbing, you see. Better not to get on that spiral, because once you get on that spiral going up, it's very hard to get off it. That's what the man in Proverbs is warning against. Flip across, if you would, to chapter 13, verse 7. Here is a man who pretends to be rich, yet he has nothing. I suppose if you make out that you're rich, you can get certain benefits and maybe attract a certain amount of praise from society, and people look at you and say, he must be going up in the world. He has a new car, a new house, a new boat, a new wife, or whatever else he has new, and so he has all these status symbols. And he's pretending to be rich, but really he's a nothing. It's all show. He says, one man pretends to be rich, yet has nothing. And then you've got the other man. This is a bit comical too, because I've got an uncle like this. He pretends to be poor, yet he has great wealth. You know the sort of person, every time you speak to him, he complains about the government and the taxes have gone up and the rates have gone up and it doesn't rain or does rain or something like that. And I heard recently that he was complaining about the tax crowd this time, that he had to pay $1,000 tax. And the $1,000 was on the interest, which constituted his total income because he's retired. And that was only the interest on all his investments. So the interest alone was attracting $1,000 tax. You see, he was pretending to be poor for the simple reason that he's mean, and yet he has great wealth. A lot of people like that, and one sometimes wonders at these people who pretend to be poor, as one wonders about those who make out that they're rich. No need for us to advertise everything about ourselves and make all our private affairs public knowledge, but there is no reason for us all to pretend to be something we're not. Jesus had a lot to say about that. Chapter 14, verse 20. Nothing very morning meeting-ish about this, is there? There's nothing high-flying through the lofty heavenly heights of Ephesians. This is all very ordinary stuff. But it's all ordinary stuff that makes up our lives. This is the Word of God. Let us take note of it. Chapter 14, verse 20, the poor is disliked even by his neighbour, for the obvious reason that you can't get anything from him. You can't even borrow a bag of cement or something like that. You can't get anything out of him, and so he doesn't have many friends. The rich, of course, has many friends. And so you butter up the boss and bring him a birthday present or whatever you happen to do. You see, the rich has many friends because you can get something from him, but the poor is left without any. He who despises his neighbour is a sinner. And we live in an era where we're becoming more and more isolated from our fellow men, more and more independent. And we do our thing and the rest of the world can go to pot. That's their business and I'll look after my business. It's not Christian, that attitude. And he who despises his neighbour is a sinner, but happy is the man who is kind to the poor. Now there's no status points in that. Some lady down the road that is bedridden and her house needs a good going through, and perhaps she's short of a meal, maybe the yard's overgrown, and just to go in and do something for her, it's not going to get you on the front page of the newspaper, but it would be a Christian thing to do. Happy is the person who is kind to the poor. What wins you status points is when you pander to the rich, or happen to have your photograph taken with the local politician or some big man around town. That's the thing that's going to get you on the step up. I was once told by a person once, with tongue in cheek of course, at a certain conference, I just went and sat with some of my friends and I was supposed to sit at high table apparently with certain dignitaries that were there. He says, you'll never make it up the scale if you sit over there. He said, they're the big wheels of the brethren system around here. You sit with them. You see, you get seen with the right people. That's what he's talking about here. People who are concerned with status, and so they progress up the ladder. But again, an unchristian attitude. Chapter 19, verse 4. Fairly obvious statements here. Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend. That's a well-known sort of statement, isn't it? I think we have proverbs like that in English. Verse 6, another one. Many seek the favour of a generous man, and everyone is a friend to a man who gives gifts. This man has had his eyes open, hasn't he? He's been walking around and making a few observations. You see, that's what wisdom teachers were. They were chaps who were sharp-eyed, and they made these observations, and they condensed them into short, pithy sayings. Chapter 19, verse 10, there's another one. It is not fitting for a fool to live in luxury, much less for a slave to rule over princes. Now, don't get that wrong. Don't think that the writer here is all on the side of the upper classes, and he says if a man is down, he's got to stay down. He's not saying that. What he's saying is, God does not want people to be misfits. He doesn't want these people making themselves out to be something when they're not. He's not saying that if you're poor, you ought to stay poor, and it's not fit that you should be rich. He's not saying that. He's saying, here's a person who simply is climbing out of his own status. He's trying to get up and make himself something higher up in the scale, when actually he's a buffoon, or he's dumb, or he's immature, or he's stupid. And he's only going to make a fool of himself, because he's grasping after something he's not really capable of holding. Like a slave trying to rule over princes. And so it goes on. Chapter 22, verse 1. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. Well, sometimes rich people have a good name, but not always. And if you've got to make a choice between the two, he says, go for the good reputation. Favour is better than silver or gold. Verse 2. The rich and the poor meet together, and the Lord is the maker of them all. Status will vary, it's inevitable. Some countries in the world have tried to eliminate the difference in status They've introduced a form of socialism or communism or Marxism or something, and of course it hasn't really worked. All it's meant is that the bureaucrats are the upper crust now instead of the former business section. Human nature is such that you'll never get that type of equality. It's just the fact of life that some are going to be better off than others. But he says the point is that regardless of this, in God's sight, they're treated as equal. They all meet together as far as God's concerned. He made them all, and he will deal with all according to his own just laws. Chapter 25, verse 6, and this is the last one. Here again is selfish ambition. There's nothing wrong with ambition. Don't think I'm having a go at people who want to get on. If you're going to be diligent, honest, and conscientious in your work, then it's only natural that you will progress. There's nothing wrong with ambition. There's everything wrong with selfish ambition. That's what James condemns in chapter 3. Wherever you get selfish ambition, he says, there you'll get disorder and every vile practice. It's selfish ambition. It's vile practice. That's what this man is talking about. So don't put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great. For it is better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of the prince. Here is the man that knows who has the power in the country, and so he is going to work his way round so that he can get to that man and somehow get in his favour and become the top man. Well, says the wise man here, don't be over ambitious, because you might find yourself embarrassingly put down. Slothfulness and laziness on the one hand, selfish ambition and status climbing on the other. Both have to be avoided. Finding the middle path is always the most difficult task for the Christian. But a greater than Solomon is here. And listen to the words of a greater than Solomon. He told a parable to those who were invited when he marked how they chose the places of honour. And he said to them, when you are invited by anyone to a marriage feast, do not sit down in a place of honour, lest a more eminent man than you be invited by him. And he who invited you both will come and say to you, give place to this man. And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. So when you're invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher. And then you will be honoured in the presence of all who sit at table with you. And here's the crunch. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. The words of our Lord are greater than Solomon.